and hear two stories develop that are both true and completely contradictory. In secret CIA files, you will find both of these stories validated. On the one hand, the CIA argued that it was afraid that it was losing the war for control of the mind, and that the Soviets had developed this new sophisticated psychology or whatever to control the way people think and act, and the America had to catch up. We were on the defensive now, and we had to a lot of work that had to be done. On the other hand, in a document that was extremely highly classified, eyes only, for the director of the CIA's eyes only, it turned out that there was a spy in the Andrassy Street prison who was reporting back to the CIA everything that was happening to Minzente. And this eyes only report, which I've read, is a wonderful document. It details exactly what happened to Minzente. It names the Soviet hypnotists who did the work and the drugs that they used to assist them in that work. It's a step-by-step manual for the programming of Minzente. And what's particularly interesting is if you read Cardinal Minzente's autobiography of the events, he really doesn't know what happened to him. And at this point, the CIA had a better knowledge of the programming of Minzente than he had of his own programming. And so on the one hand, the CIA knew everything that the Soviets were doing, yet on the other hand, they were reporting that they were afraid that they were losing the war. And I think both of those stories are true, though they're contradictory, and both are supported by secret CIA documents. Meanwhile, a related event begins to happen. In the late 1940s, Edward Hunter, in 1949, for the first time, coins the term brainwashing and writes a book on it. This is one of the two books that Hunter wrote. It turned out that Hunter was an OSS and then later CIA propagandist. And the word brainwashing was particularly useful because American prisoners of war were starting to give confessions of using germ warfare during the Korean War. And America needed a way of stopping that kind of propaganda. And the term brainwashing, which had been coined by Hunter to explain the thought reform program in communist China, proved a useful vehicle. This is Edward Hunter. I was able to do one of the last interviews with him before his death. In the deep literature on brainwashing, the more academic literature on brainwashing, his view of it is called the robot theory, the notion that with brainwashing techniques you can turn somebody into an automaton. The robot theory of brainwashing is not the only theory of brainwashing, but it is the most flamboyant, and it's also the most frightening. The idea of brainwashing then in the 1950s became the object of a lot of study and writing in books like In Every War But One. People who'd actually gone through the experience wrote about what had happened to them, and researchers like Biderman in books like this were reporting what happened to American prisoners of war and other prisoners of war. In Hawaii, an American camp was set up to be a mock prison of war camp to use the techniques that were being used of brainwashing. This is an illustration from that camp. These are actually all Americans, but it's a simulated exercise in brainwashing because Americans were searching for a way to inoculate our soldiers. If they should get captured and put through a brainwashing experience, would it have been possible for us to inoculate them previously so the brainwashing would not take? While the brainwashing studies were going on, another development was happening simultaneously important to the development of mind control, and these are the sensory deprivation experiments that began in Canada with Donald Hebb and others. It was Hebb's original work was essentially on what's called highway trance, the phenomena that people who will drive on highways in long stretches of road that that's pretty monotonous, will go into trance. And this is a form of sensory deprivation. If it's dark at night, there's a long road, there's no scenery. You probably all have had the experience of realizing you've suddenly driven a couple of miles but have no memory for that couple of miles passing, or you've gotten very drowsy. Well, the phenomenon of sensory deprivation became the subject of a good deal of study in the 1950s. What would happen to the mind if it were deprived of sensory input, since the mind needs sensory input the way the body needs food? And in a series of studies, this is on isolation. Inside the black rooms, students in universities across the country, in Canada and other places, were put in a black room. Here's an illustration of it. There's essentially almost no sensory input at all. What happens to the mind? Flotation tanks and other ways of decreasing sensory input all had the effect of causing the mind, when it is deprived of sensory input, to throw out a hallucinated world in order to get input back from that hallucinated world. And people, in fact, kept in isolation too long could become psychotic. Books studying the phenomena of isolation, and also in conjunction with manipulating people's mind through techniques of brainwashing, began to appear. The Brain Benders is one. The Battle for the Mind by William Sargent is the foremost British book on this subject. Robert J. Lifton's study, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, is the classic work on the Chinese thought reform program. Edgar Schein's book on coercive persuasion on the Americans taken prisoner during the Korean War. Rape of the Mind by Mirlu, another classic. As all of this was happening, this was what you could call a form of coercive persuasion, as Schein had suggested. But there was another event that was occurring simultaneously. The 1950s is in many ways the birth of mind control experimentation, because you have the brainwashing issue, the hypnosis issues, the isolation and sensory deprivation studies, and you now get the next stream of research, which involves obedience to authority studies. I mentioned the other night Solomon Ash's studies on opinions and social pressure, and what Ash did at Yale was the simplest of experiments on conformity. He drew on a blackboard a line that was 1 foot long and another line directly under it, parallel to it, that was 2 feet long. He then got six or seven people in a room, all of whom except one had been bribed. And the last one had no knowledge of the bribing of the others. He then asked them in order which one was the shorter line. And to the horror of the one who was not bribed, everyone reported that the 2 foot line was the shorter line. And it was visually obvious that that was untrue, but everybody else in the room was reporting it as true. And what Ash discovered was that the subject would report seeing the longer line as the shorter line, that he would conform to peer pressure. Cynics dismissed it on the grounds that it just showed the stupidity of Yale graduates, but that was not a sufficient scientific explanation. As Walter reported the other night, the experiments were done in the Navy and other places as well. Now, I want to distinguish this group of work from the others that I've just reported on. Here we're talking about a form of manipulation of the mind that does not involve physical coercion. In the brainwashing work, in the isolation work, there is a form of physical intimidation that involves taking over the body and controlling the body, controlling all of the input in the mind, and so forth. And so this is a person in that situation knows that he or she is in that situation, that they are captive in some way. With this kind of experimentation, we have what I call conversational persuasion. This is the beginning of the attempt to develop theories of social influence on freestanding populations where people are not aware that they are being held captive in any way, and indeed they're not. The next step along the lines of obedience research, and in some ways the most frightening, is the work done by Milgram and his book Obedience to Authority. And if you're not familiar with Milgram's work, I'll give you a very brief explanation of it. Milgram wanted to test the hypothesis that, that people in Germany, good people in Germany, during the Nazi regime, were manipulated in a way to do evil. Or let me restate that. Milgram wondered why so many good people in Nazi Germany could allow such evil to happen around them knowingly. And his thesis was not the idea that there's something inherent in the German character, but rather that there's something inherent in people. And he was interested in showing whether or not, if a Hitler-type character arose in the United States, that person would be able to get good people to do evil in this country. And so he built a box. I don't have a slide of it here. He built a box with 30 switches, just little light switches. And the 30 switches were in 15-volt increments. They were marked in 15-volt increments. As you move over towards the right of the box, there began to be some writing which said caution, danger, extreme danger, and the last group of switches were marked in triple red X's. Now, he then put an advertisement, again, this is at Yale, so you know maybe the cynics are right. He put an advertisement in the local New Haven newspaper for people to volunteer for the experiment. People came in and they were told that the experiment involved pain and learning, and that they would be the teachers, and that there was a student and they could see the student. And the student, they were told, was hooked up to an electric grid. And every time the teacher was to give the student a question, and every time the student gave a wrong answer, one of the switches was to be pushed. When Milgram and his associates talked about the experiment, they concluded that nobody would push all the switches, and most people would stop pushing the switches about halfway through, because each switch was intended to deliver a higher voltage shock. The subject, as about half the switches were pulled, would increasingly flinch and then scream and then yell, would then say, I don't want to do this anymore, would then say, I have a heart condition, please stop, and then would refuse to answer any question and would slump over. If the teacher balked at pushing the next switch, there was an experimenter there in a long white laboratory coat with a clipboard and a pencil who was instructed to say first continue and then please continue and then you must go on with the experiment and finally I will take responsibility. And what Milgram discovered is that the overwhelming number of people pushed all of the switches. And that the simple reinforcement of saying, I will take responsibility, or that there was an experiment going on, was sufficient to allow them to do that. Now, Milgram's experiments were replicated in other places, what eventually evolved is that the horror of what he was proving was so ghastly that the scientific literature turned away from it and instead focused on the ethics of doing that kind of experiment. Because after all, what he was doing is taking people from the street and not telling them that they were what he was studying. They thought he was studying the subject. And a lot of these people, as you can imagine, had severe emotional reaction once they realized that they had shocked somebody with a heart condition on a machine that went beyond extreme danger to triple X's in red. And so the ethics of doing that kind of work then created a movement in universities and other places for institutional review boards, etc., and the research can't be done anymore. And what Milgram was proving how easy it is to manipulate people by the simplest of commands, was no longer being studied, and certainly not in that manner. But books like Compliant Behavior, Beyond Obedience to Authority, were being written to increase and replicate and extend the work of Milgram. And here's a report called Conformity, Compliance, and Conversion from an Air Force in, I think, around the 1950s, an Air Force report using Milgram's work in Air Force conditioning. Give me a moment, take a break. I want to change the slides for the next carousel. Let's go back and talk some more about hypnosis, since it plays a central role in the rest of the development of mind control. Let me say that also, given the nature of the subject of mind control, there are a lot of things I'm not talking about. I'm not going to be talking to you about the physiological aspects of mind control to take you through the lobotomy and psychosurgery and electrical stimulation of the brain literature. And I won't be talking about the pharmacological aspects of mind control, the use of drugs and botanicals and chemicals for mind control. You know, but that should give you an idea of how vast the subject is. We're just concentrating here on the psychological aspects of mind control. All right. The notion of hypnotic seduction had been noticed in the secret report to the king in France. It had been noticed by Freud in his work, and it had been noticed by many others. A series of slides on hypnotic seduction. The idea of hypnotic seduction got, I think, its greatest impetus in an 1894 book called Trilby. And this is an illustration from it with the infamous Svengali as the hypnotist. And to this day, the portrait of Svengali as a hypnotist is almost as powerful as Sherlock Holmes as a detective. It's almost the stereotype of the field. In Trilby today would be a number one bestseller, the equivalent of a number one bestseller, and even bigger. It was probably the first blockbuster novel. It was published in a magazine in serial form, and after the first issue appeared, the magazine had to print an additional 100,000 copies because of the desire for people to continue the story. The author, George du Maurier, was launched into such public light that he ultimately hid from all, in order to preserve his privacy. He had lecture tours through the United States and Britain. You remember Peyton Place, how huge a novel that was at the time? This was the equivalent and even bigger. The story of Trilby is the story of a hypnotist who gets total control over the personality of a young woman. And the novel itself, I find to be incredibly boring. But the portrait portrayed in of the hypnotist is tremendously exciting and has lived on almost as an icon of the subject itself. There was a town in Florida, and I haven't checked to see whether this is still true, that changed its name to Trilby. And in the center of town, they have Svengali Square. There were Trilby parties, Trilby hats, Trilby clothes. It was an enormously popular and influential novel, which introduced people to the idea of the potential for hypnotic seduction, and also even worse. Since I don't want to dwell on this aspect of mind control, let me sum it up and say that the traditional thinking has been that you cannot get people to do with hypnosis what they would not otherwise do. There is value in that thinking because it then doesn't encourage people to try. But if you go and talk to the hypnotist who will tell you that, and you talk to them in private, they will tell you the opposite story. That within certain parameters, you can get people to do things they would otherwise not do with hypnosis. and that while their hypnosis is not a magic wand or a magic potion, it is an effective facilitator for seduction or antisocial conduct. There is an increase in court cases of hypnotic seduction now, but I want to turn to the more frightening prospect of using hypnosis for the creation of antisocial crimes. Can you get, you are in my power, you will do what I tell you. How far can you get control of somebody using hypnosis and forms of social influence? This has been the subject of a lot of fiction. Just from my library, here are some of the books. The Darker the Night, was The Hypnotist the Killer? Seeing is Believing. Your Eyelids Are Growing Heavy. Murder is Suggested. Telephone, which of course is a movie as well. And there are academic books like Hypnotism and Crime. Interestingly, there has been no major work on the antisocial aspects of hypnosis, either in the legal literature or in the psychiatric, hypnotic, or psychological literature for over 30 years. 1960 is the last time we have a full discussion of the issue of hypnotic coercion. And 1972 was the last time a hypnosis journal directed itself primarily to that issue. The texts suggest that there are cases in which people, through hypnosis, have been induced to commit crimes, but the hypnosis community has been divided as to whether those are pure cases. There is what I call the methodological dilemma that arises at this point. Usually the hypnotic encounter requires a certain amount of time and a certain amount of trust. And so hypnosis researchers argue that it's not hypnosis that facilitates either seduction or the production of antisocial acts. Rather, it is the relationship between the hypnotist and the subject, and therefore hypnosis is not at fault. The experimentalists discount any clinical anecdotal material because it's not rigorously scientific and therefore can't prove the conclusion of hypnotic coercion. But the experimental literature itself is discounted because, as Albert Mohl wrote 100 years ago and Martin Orne has written as well, at some level a subject always knows that he or she is participating in an experiment. And so there is no way to test the validity of the hypothesis that you can induce through hypnosis antisocial conduct. On the other hand, such conduct is produced on a regular basis, whatever the explanation. The one place where the studies were done where there was no fear of ethical violation or legal consequences was in work done by the Central Intelligence Agency. And since the work has never been fully published, I have an article that will be coming out in the American Journal of Clinical Hypnosis on the CIA hypnosis experiments. It's not my function here to criticize the intelligence agencies or to condemn what they have done. I'm instead trying to argue the point that the hypnosis community in general, and psychologists and psychiatrists as well, need to know the data that was produced and which still exists in CIA files. If we are going to be accused by the false memory people of using undue suggestion to get people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do, we need to know the limits of those possibilities. And that material is in CIA files. Therapists are being sued across the country. They need access to that information to help defend themselves. And so it is in the spirit of science and in the spirit of protecting therapists and patients, for the good of the country, that I present this material so that we can hope that the full amount of it is ultimately revealed. I also must make a caveat. I can only report on information that I've seen either through my search of CIA files and my interviews with CIA hypnotists and other hypnotists. There may be mistakes in what I present. I cannot correct that unless I have access to all of the material. And so if I have made a mistake, it is a mistake that comes from not being given the material, because I have in good faith worked through the material I have to tell as accurate a story as I know how. The CIA began experimenting as soon as it was born in the late 1940s. The experimentation and mind and behavior control had already begun in the OSS with hypnosis experiments, truth serums, truth tablets, and lethal pills, as well as other kinds of experiments. But it was after the Cardinal Mindszenty episode that the CIA began to really become concerned about the possibility of hypnotic coercion. And let me quote to you from a CIA document at the time. This is a February 10th, 1951 CIA top secret memo called Defense Against Soviet Medical Interrogation and Espionage Techniques. Quote, hypnotism has been reported to have been used in some cases by the Soviets as an adjunct to interrogation. It would be possible for a skilled Soviet operator to lower a prisoner's resistance to questioning and yet leave him with no specific recollections of having been interrogated. With respect to inducing specific action on the part of a subject by hypnotism, it would be possible to brief a prisoner or other individual, subsequently dispatch him on a mission, and successfully debrief him on his return without his recollection of the whole proceeding. A June 1951 CIA memo says, quote, CIA interest is in the specific subject of devising scientific methods for controlling the minds of individuals, unquote. And so by in the late 1940s, some essentially uncontrolled experimentation was begun by various people within the CIA, and a more structured program was also undertaken, which had the name Bluebird, and that name was then changed to Artichoke. And under Projects Bluebird and Artichoke, the attempt was made to bring together all known knowledge of interrogation techniques, truth serums, polygraphs, and hypnosis to create essentially an elite interrogation team with facility in all of those endeavors and have them do the work that would be needed, first of all, to protect against infiltration by enemy agents, and also to protect the minds of American agents who might get captured by communist individuals. And why did they do that? Ooh, yeah.
We've been listening to Dr. Alan Shefflin give a lecture on the history of mind control, what we can prove and what we can't. We're going to be continuing with that lecture next week. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're in the middle of an extended radio series on mind control. I hope that this lecture and some of the other interviews and lectures have set the background of mind control to contextualize what we're going to be featuring on upcoming shows. We're going to hear from survivors, their accounts of their experiences with government mind control experiments and how they were used by their government. You've been listening to The International Connection here on CKLN 88.1. Stay tuned next for Aquí Nuestra America. Forward and away they go. Daniel in the lion's den. They thought they would never see. Corrientes del Sur y CKLN invitan a todas y todos al Festival Internacional de Cortometrajes Latinoamericanos en Cine y Video Cruzando Fronteras. En el Centro Harbor Front, mayo 21 al 24. Este año estaremos presentando obras ganadoras de premios internacionales realizadas en Canadá, Brasil, México, Argentina, Bolivia, Guayana Francesa, Perú, Colombia, Venezuela y Estados Unidos. Venga y participe en este acto revolucionario celebrando nuestra diversidad cultural. Comparta la riqueza y calidad de las nuevas propuestas cinematográficas de nuestros artistas. Para mayor información, llame al 973-3000. Reservación de tickets en el 973-4000. Te esperamos en el estudio del Centro Harbor Front, mayo 21 al 24.
¿Qué tal, amigos y amigas? Muy buenos días. Les saluda Neri Espinosa y el colectivo de Aquí Nuestra América. Una vez más en sus hogares, gracias por permitírnoslo. Como ustedes saben, nuestro programa se transmite todos los domingos, con excepción del primer domingo de cada mes, cuando están aquí con ustedes las compañeras y amigas de Tejiendo Rebeldías. Para este domingo 18 de mayo de 1997, hemos preparado un par de entrevistas para ustedes. Una de ellas es con Jorge Lozano. Él es director del segundo Festival Latinoamericano de Cortometraje y Video, que se inicia el próximo miércoles 21 y va hasta el 24 de mayo en el Harbor Front Center, o sea, en el centro de Harbor Front. Asimismo, también estará con nosotros a través de una entrevista Patricia Gómez. Ella trabaja para el Centro de Derechos Humanos San Bartolomé de las Casas.